a few weeks ago, some of you may have been here during the Waisak period. I gave a couple of talks on the Buddha's life, and I found that ran seriously out of time, and so various things that I wanted to talk about, I didn't get round to it. So one of the things I wanted to talk about in some more detail was the passing away of the Buddha, the Mahaparinibbana, and so I might use that as the topic for this evening's talk. And of course the Buddha's passing away, one of the three great deaths recorded in ancient literature, the death of the Buddha, Socrates and Jesus being the big three. And in each case the not only the person's life, the way that they lived, but the manner of their death also became a very powerful, very important part of how they affected and how they influenced subsequent generations. So just to set the scene, of course, the Buddha died in ripe old age, I guess, 80 years old. Even though we have the commonly thought that we have the idea that people in ancient times lived a lot less than they do today, lived shorter lifespans. But in fact, the Buddhist scriptures always say that a full lifespan was considered to be 100 years. And of course that doesn't mean the average lifespan, but that means like a good, full, well-lived life. So 80 was perhaps even a little bit on the short side, but certainly wasn't considered to be extraordinarily long. And there's some very interesting context around the time of what's happening. The Buddha, of course, had been teaching for 45 years by that stage. And in that 45 years, that there's no doubt that his teaching was very successful, that he'd gathered a large following, and that his teaching was put on a reasonably sure footing as far as these things can go. But of course, it's always uncertain, isn't it? And religious and spiritual teachings are popping up all the time. We can see that around us today. Constantly, every few weeks, there's a new kind of phenomenon, you know, a new guru or teacher or method or book or something. A new church is starting up every week or something like that. Somebody starts a new church. And most of them, of course, don't survive very long. Most of them come up and pass away fairly transient. So what is it about it? Why should this religion last? In ancient India, it was a very fertile field. So many different philosophies and wandering teachers and ascetics and all of these things. Why is it that the Buddha's teachings flourished so well, whereas so many others have disappeared and there's no trace of them, or in many cases just a name or a trace of an idea? So you could understand that there would be a great deal of nervousness, yeah, as it came, as the time came for the Buddha to pass away. Yeah, such a great leader, and when he's getting old, you can imagine in the community there must have been a sense of fear about the future. Is what's going to happen after the Buddha dies? Who's going to lead the community? Is everything just going to fall apart? What's actually going to be happening in the future? And this is still the case today. And you can see, for example, in Thailand, the instability in Thailand, obviously, recent instability has many causes, but one of the major background causes is the age of the king, who's now older than the Buddha was and is likely to die soon. He's been hospitalized for many months. And so there's this kind of tension, what's going to happen, this uncertainty that surrounds it. And it's not just that the Buddha himself was dying, but when you look at the historical context, that uncertainty was everywhere. During his lifetime, the Buddha had been supported by two of the great kings in the time, King Bimbisara of Magadha and King Pasenadi of Kosala. King Bimbisara had recently been murdered by his son Ajatasattu, who was a much more kind of warlike and cruel king than his father. And likewise, King Pasenadi had not been literally murdered by his son, but had been overthrown in a coup by his son and had died shortly after. So the two great supporters that the Buddha had, both had died recently. Not only that, but the Buddha's chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, both of them died shortly before the Buddha. Yeah? And there's one very, very poignant sutta where the Buddha is sitting there in the midst of the Sangha, and he looks around all the monks sitting there, and he says, "The Sangha looks like it's empty now that Sariputta and Moggallana are not here." Yeah? That's the closest that the Buddha gets to being kind of being attached or being nostalgic or something like that. Yeah, that's the closest that he gets. Oh, it's not the same now. Sariputta and Moggallana have gone. So you can get this kind of feeling of things starting to fall apart. Yeah. And at the beginning, the story of the death of the Buddha is this great sutta, magnificent text called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta is by far the longest of all the early Buddhist discourses, and for all we know, quite possibly was the largest and most ambitious literary achievement in ancient India at that time, yeah, for all that we know. Remembering that all these were put together as part of the oral tradition, so it's not like you can kind of sit there and write a text off the top of your head, but it all has to be prepared, all has to be memorized and so on to construct a kind of a literary text of length is very difficult, yeah? So to make up, say, a song in an oral literature is fairly easy, yeah? And to memorize that. And most of the old oral literature is things like that. It's things like collections of hymns or poems or something. But this is like a consciously planned long story, like a little novel, small novel. And the very beginning of that small novel, the Buddha is saying in Rajagaha, and King Ajatasattu, I mentioned before, was a newly crowned king, and he spoke to his minister and says, I want to crush and destroy the Vajjayan Republic. Okay, so the Vajjayans were his northern borders. King Ajatasattu was ruler of a kingdom that was just south of the Ganges in the middle of India. And the Magadhan kingdom and the Vajjayan Republic was just on the northern side, the northern shores of the Ganges. And he said, even though the Vajjayans are so powerful and wealthy and successful, still I'm going to crush and destroy them all. So then he says to his minister, well, why don't you go and ask the Buddha about this, see what he says. Okay? Because Buddhas never lie. So it does seem a rather curious thing to be getting the Buddha's advice about, doesn't it? Yeah? What kind of, you know, what kind of response is the Buddha going to give? Yeah? And you know, and it also gives this insight into it's very, very characteristic of Ajatasattu's character. He's a fascinating historical character because he was obviously quite a cruel, aggressive, warlike king, no doubt about that. But also had this spiritual leaning, yeah, which is of his very conflicted character. He wants to know what the Buddha thinks about his plans to go and wipe out all these people. What does he think that the Buddha is going to say? Yeah, well, go. Should I go and invade and kill all these people? But of course, the Buddha's in a very delicate position, yeah, because what do you do? Do you tell the king, no, don't go and invade them? You know, it's wrong. or you know, you could be in quite a delicate situation. So anyway, his minister comes to see him and says, this is what the king's proposing, and what does the Buddha reckon? Okay. So Buddha, of course, doesn't hesitate, right? And he speaks to Venerable Ananda, who's his constant companion and attendant, and says to him, Ananda, do you recall that I taught the 8 conditions of prosperity to the Vajjayans? And he says, yes. He says, do you remember what those 8 conditions were? And so then he goes on and lists 8 conditions for the prosperity of the Vajjayan people. And I can't remember off the top of my head what all 8 conditions were, but some of them were that they should meet frequently, right, and carry on their business in harmony and break up in harmony. Yeah? So this is one. Vajjayans, just by the way, were a semi-democratic society, probably best described as perhaps not autocratic, as a what's the word I'm looking for? It'll come to me in a minute. But they were run by like a confederation of the leading clans. Okay, so it was ruled by the upper class, the sort of the landowners and landowning class collectively would rule democratically. So it wasn't, it was a democracy, but it wasn't universal democracy in our modern sense. So this is when he's talking about the meetings, this is what he's referring to. They would have had a central hall in the middle of their town, and then all of the leaders would have got together and debated their business and so on. And then he said that was one of the principles he established. Another one was that they should provide protection. Interesting one, they said they should provide protection for the women and the safety of the women in the realm. He said that they should maintain their ancient traditional customs and not neglect their traditional customs. He said that they should maintain the shrines and the religious customs as well. So these various things that he recommended for the safety and stability of the realm. And he asked Ananda, he said, when I taught these, he said, has the Vajjayans actually been keeping these? Have they been following these principles? And Ananda said, yes, they have. And he said, well, that will be for a long time for their prosperity and their well-being. And when the minister heard this, he said, well, if the Vajjayans were keeping even one of those principles, then there'd be no way to defeat them. Yeah, how much more so if they were keeping all 8? Yeah, so as long as their society was harmonious and functioning well together, they couldn't be defeated. So it was a very kind of diplomatic way the Buddha did it. He didn't directly respond to the question, but had a discussion about how the Vajjayan people were living. And he said, there's no, and so the minister then said, well, there's no way that they can possibly be defeated except by sowing internal dissension among them. Yeah? And so he said, okay, so he got that idea from the Buddha indirectly. And went off and no doubt told King Ajatasattu that's how they're going to defeat them. And that's, we don't actually know. We know that the Vajjayans were defeated within a few generations, and quite likely that's how they did it. We don't know the details, though. So it's a very interesting dynamic here, very interesting situation, which has a lot of ramifications for the social context that the Buddha was teaching in. Then the Buddha then called the Sangha together and then taught the Sangha 8 principles for how the Sangha, the monastic community, should live together. And those 8 principles were modelled after the principles which the Vajjayan Republic were using. So, for example, that the Sangha should meet together frequently, that they should carry on their business in harmony, and they should break up in harmony, that they should make new rules or abolish old rules, but should practice according to the customs and the rules laid down, and so on. So the similar kinds of principles adapted to the Sangha life. So this is very important, sociologically very important, that the ideal spiritual community which the Buddha envisaged and which the Buddha set up was one which was based on the democratic ideals of the Vajjian Republic rather than one based on the autocratic ideals of the kingdoms which were there at the time. And this passage in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is quite pointed, it's quite deliberate, and saying this is, I want the Sangha to model themselves on this kind of democratic model, not by implication on the autocratic model of King Ajatasattu. So the Buddha then started his journey, okay, his last journey. You can imagine this now, 80 years old, walking with his attendant, Ananda. Now, Ananda was a generation younger than the Buddha. He would have been perhaps 50 or so at the time. And the Buddha, even though he's quite old, still obviously reasonably fit and able to walk considerable distances. They set out north from Rajagaha. And of course, these days we can go to that area and we can see the districts around, although the lay of the land would be much the same as in those days, but the terrain is very different. In terms of those days, it would have been huge forests everywhere, and now the forests have almost all gone. And so we can imagine the Buddha walking north. He walked a little bit north to Nalanda. And it was at Nalanda, so they say, that he received the news of the passing away of Venerable Sariputta. He met Sariputta for the last time and then later heard news of his passing away. There are some chronological problems with the text, which I won't go into here. And each stop along the way, each step on the journey, he met with people, the local villagers, people around him. The monks who were living in the area, he would have discussions and so on and teach various important Dhamma teachings. And there's no doubt that this is meant to, in some ways, summarize and to encapsulate what were the Buddha's most important messages. And he's repeating the same messages again and again and again. And one of the most characteristic of those is the teaching on Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And constantly in that he's saying that when one's ethics, when one's virtuous conduct is fulfilled and developed, then that will fulfill one's concentration, and when concentration is fulfilled, then that will fulfill one's wisdom, and then when wisdom is fulfilled, then one will be freed from all afflictions. This is this passage which is found again and again in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And the word that's used is paribhavita, and paribhavita means to be like suffused through or soaked through. Yeah? So when the concentration is soaked through with ethics, yeah, or when the wisdom is soaked through with concentration, yeah. So it's this very kind of embodied language that the Buddha's using. There's all of these things that are integrated and like it's completely soaked through. And then this is what leads to liberation. And this is taught again and again and again. As well as these repeated teachings and repeated themes, then there are certain specific ideas which are taught at various times and places. And I won't go into all of the details of the narrative, but I would certainly encourage you to get hold of this sutta. There's some good translations of it around, and it's a very inspiring read and a very moving one. Yeah, just the Buddha just moving, and then it's just these little personal moments when he's with Ananda and he's sitting there warming his back in the last rays of the sun, and Ananda says, "Oh, you know, it's amazing how much I've seen you've aged." Yeah? And the Buddha says, "How could it be otherwise? Yeah, whatever's born has to get old." So you see, this kind of Ananda's got this great love for the Buddha. Yeah, he's sort of wants to hold on to him, wants to keep him there, and the Buddha's this kind of acceptance of his own mortality. The whole text, I think, was written by Ananda. Well, not written, but composed by Ananda. Yeah. He's there right from the beginning right through to the end. He's part of the narrative. And it's actually almost as much the story of Ananda as it is the story of the Buddha. Of course, like all early Buddhist texts, it doesn't have an author as such. There's no byline at the end of the text, right? But I feel, personally, I feel quite certain that after the Buddha passed away, Ananda lived for a few decades after that. And I think that he really poured his heart into into so many things, but in this particular sutra, I think, is where he really poured his heart into and creating this as a monument to his beloved teacher. Again, not in a dissimilar way to the way that, Plato wrote the account of the trial and the death of Socrates, or the way that the writers of the Gospels wrote of the death of Jesus. And so many quite fascinating incidents happened around this time, and you find the quite a lot of miracles are attributed to this sort of period. So, for example, the incident of the Buddha, when the Buddha asked for a glass of water, right? So the Buddha got sick at one stage, and so he said to Ananda, "Can you get me a glass of water?" And Ananda said, "Oh, there's just this train of oxen has just been through the creek just near here, and it's all muddy. So we need to go on further to the next creek and find some clean water, and then you can have a drink." And he said, "No, Ananda, please just go down here and get some water." And Ananda says, no, just we go up ahead, there's another creek, and we get some clean water." The Buddha says, "Ananda, do you reckon you could just go and get me some water?" Ananda's like, "Oh, God, if I must." And so he goes down, takes the Buddha's bowl down, and as soon as he gets to the water, all the mud settles. It becomes completely pure and clean, and he collects perfectly clean water to give to the Buddha. Yeah? So even Ananda, yeah, who had so much faith, of all the disciples, the one who had so much faith and love in the Buddha, yeah, still doubting the Buddha's power, yeah. And so there's quite a few little incidents like this, and you know, one can interpret these, you know, in a literal sense if you like, or you can interpret it, if we understand that the text was composed by Ananda, yeah, more or less, and that, you know, somehow he's saying something in these stories about his own attitude to and relationship to the Buddha, somehow encapsulated in these little episodes. And the more famous one, of course, is the story where the Buddha says to Ananda, "Oh, just by the way, just to let you know that anybody who's developed the four bases of psychic power can live, oh, you know, to the end of the eon if they want. You know? And I've developed those, by the way." Ananda, nothing. But it says, just so that you know, and just so we're sure clear on this, you know, anyone who's developed these four bases of psychic power, right to the end of the eon, they can live about a few billion years, no problems. I've developed them. Just to let you know. Nothing, Ananda. The third time, he says. And then, because Ananda didn't ask him, yeah, so then he says, okay, that's it. So he relinquishes the life faculty. Right? So there's this actual passage there where the Buddha actually says, you know, I've given up the will to live. The ayu sankhara literally means the will to live, or the life force. And he let go of it. He relinquished it. Yeah. And then after he did that, then there was a great earthquake. Yeah. So the earth shook and trembled because of the power of that moment. Yeah? So then, of course, Ananda comes to the Buddha and says, "Why was the earth shaking?" And the Buddha said, "Well, of course, there's, being a Buddhist text, of course, you have to have not just an explanation, but a list of the eight causes of earthquakes." Yeah. So there are these eight causes of earthquakes, and then goes on to list them all. And the last one is when the Tathagata, when the Buddha gives up his will to live. And then Ananda says, "Oh my God. No, please, live on to the end of the eon, yeah? We live on." He says, "No, Ananda, it's too late, yeah?" "It's your fault, Ananda." Yeah? My fault. And he says, "My mind was clouded by Mara." Yeah? So Mara, the tempter, the deluder, had taken over Ananda's mind, and that's why he didn't beg the Buddha to live on to the end of the eon. Which raises a kind of a whole bunch of very interesting questions, yeah? What would really happen if the Buddha did live on to the end of the eon? Yeah? He'd still be alive today. Yeah? It's kind of curious. Would he still be 80 years old? Like, it just says you can live. He didn't say you could stop the aging process. So maybe you keep on getting older, and you just don't die. It could be. So. And then that whole thing. So, I mean, again, you can interpret that, in many ways. And like, you know, these kind of texts and these mythic texts, they're meant to be open-ended. They're not meant to lock down a doctrine, yeah? So there are plenty of Buddhist texts when the Buddha was very decisive and explicit and said, you know, this means this, and gave a very kind of detailed explanation. That's what it means, and that's the reason, and, you know, it's fairly secure, you know, you've nailed down the meaning as much as you can, reasonably speaking. But these kinds of things are not like that. These kinds of things are very open. It's meant to raise questions. It's meant to evoke a sense of wonder. You know, is this possible? It's a question that Buddhists have been asking themselves ever since that time. Is it really possible to use your psychic powers and your meditative abilities to live on to the end of the eon? I mean, I think none of us would be surprised with the idea that through meditative or yogic practices that you can extend your lifetime. Yeah? In fact, probably a lot of us are hoping that it will, yeah? And in the Indian tradition, generally it's said that your lifespan is measured by your breaths. Yeah? So that when you meditate, you learn your breathing is slowed down, yeah? And you breathe less. And so because you're breathing less, then your lifespan will be extended. Yeah? That's the way that they think about it. But I think, you know, it's fairly easy to understand that, you know, doing the meditation and the yogic practices, you know, making your mind peaceful, not so much tension and so on in your body, then, you know, you can be healthy and you can live longer. How much longer? 10 years? 20 years? Maybe, yeah. 100 years? 1 billion years? Somewhere along that spectrum, we cross a certain boundary line, don't we? Yeah, we move from the reasonable into the we've been leveraged out of a historical text. Yeah, now we've been put into the mythic realm. Yeah, we're no longer living in that. It's no longer a piece of journalism in that sense. Yeah, and so the Buddhist, as with all of these moments, the Buddhist tradition will then debate this, and it's one of those questions which is always comes up for debate and so on, and the traditional explanations will vary as well. Sometimes the traditional explanations will say that that in fact what the word used for an eon, a kappa, just means a full lifespan, which would have been 100 years. Okay, so what actually the Buddha was saying was he could live for another 20 years, right? That's one traditional explanation given in the ancient commentaries, yeah. So they obviously attempt to rationalize the text. The word kappa or eon is never used in the sense of a full lifespan. It's always used in the sense of a cosmic eon. So this is a later attempt to rationalize the text. Other explanations of it take it for granted that it was meant perfectly literally. And not only that, but that many people, many of the great enlightened beings, did in fact live on for centuries. And this is a very well-established piece of Buddhist lore. And there's many, many legends through Indian texts, Chinese texts, Tibetan texts and things like that of arahants who still lived on for hundreds or thousands of years. And in fact, that continues today. And there are many people today, there are many legends in places like Burma of a monk called Upagupta. It's just one example, who was supposed to have lived in the time of King Ashoka 2,200 years ago. And Upagupta lives on a island or in the middle of the ocean, and he's still today, and you can still see him, and you can still give alms to him if you're very lucky. Yeah? So you have to look out for just in case, right? You see a small, dark, and very ugly monk with damp robes with bits of seaweed on them. Okay, and so if you see him, A little bit like a sea monster, yeah. So if you see a monk like that, then that's extra special merit to make an offering, yeah? So not just Upagupta, many of the Buddha's disciples, Rahula, Pindola Bharadvaja, there's another monk, Pindola Bharadvaja was one of the great arahants in the time of the Buddha. But he made a big mistake one time, poor old Pindola. And he was walking into town for alms one day with Moggallana, who's the Buddha's the master of psychic powers. And at that time there was a merchant in the middle of Rajagaha who wanted to test who was like the really cool monks, okay? So to do that, he made a big pole in the middle of the city square, and on top of that put a very nice monk's bowl made out of sandalwood, okay? A very high pole. And he said, okay, any monk who can use their psychic powers, fly up in the air and grab the bowl, can have it as a prize, yeah? So, of course, all of the ascetics were sitting around the pole trying to meditate and do all their yogic practices so they could fly up in the air and grab this bowl. And, of course, this being a Buddhist text, none of them could do it, right? And so then when Pindola and Moggallana, this is all completely beside the point of the actual thing, but it's just a story, right? Pindola and Moggallana came in and they kind of saw this and Moggallana said to Pindola, you're an arahant, you've got psychic powers, why don't you fly up and get the ball? And Pindola says to Moggallana, you're an arahant, you've got psychic powers, why don't you fly up and get the ball? This is all taken absolutely straight, literally from the Vinaya, from the ancient Buddhist monastic code. This is word, almost word for word. He says, no, come on, you go and do it. He says, no, you go and do it. He says, all right, I'll go and do it. So Pindola flies up in the air, takes the bowl, and then does three victory laps with the bowl around, flying in the air around the city of Rajagaha. So he gets back to the Buddha and gets back to the monastery, and the Buddha says, Pindola, is that a new bowl you have there? He says, yes. He says, how did you win that bowl? How did you get that bowl? And he told him the story, and the Buddha says, no, Pindola. He said that that's not the right way for a monk to behave. He said, for a monk, and literally what the Buddha said was, for a monk to display their psychic powers for the sake of a miserable wooden bowl is like a hooker who shows off her private parts for the sake of a miserable penny. Yeah? So that was the Buddha's response, okay? Now, according to the Theravadan tradition, the Pali tradition, the matter ended there. Poor old Pindola got his bit of admonishment, and that was it. But according to the northern traditions, Mahayana traditions, as a result of that, the Buddha said that he was punished by not being able to enter Parinibbana. He was forced to live on forever to the end of eternity and to the end of the eon with his psychic powers as a punishment. And he became the patron saint of the monastery kitchen because of his association with bowls. Yeah? So even to today, in the Mahayana monasteries, Pindola is the patron saint of the monastery refectory. Yeah? So this is a little story about how you can live on to the end of the eon. So anyway, coming back to the story of the Buddha. So, he says, I can live on to the end of the eon. Ananda forgets to ask him, and he says, okay, so he passes away. A little bit before that, actually, I sort of haven't been telling all of this in strict chronological order, but a little bit before that, there's another episode where Mara, the Buddhist Satan, the Buddhist tempter, comes to the Buddha and says, you know, time to die now. Yeah. Right? So Mara is trying to get the Buddha. He says, well, you know, why don't you just die? Yeah. And then they recall the story. Actually, this is a repeat of something that happened just after the Buddha's enlightenment. So shortly after the Buddha became enlightened, 45 years earlier, Mara came to him and said, you know, you're happy now, you're enlightened and everything like that. Why bother living on? Yeah? Life is suffering. Yeah? So Mara is always the voice of compassion. Yeah? Oh, it's this hassle, you've got to eat, stuff, you know, you've got to talk to all these people, do all this teaching, no one's going to understand you. you know, if you're successful, they get jealous, they'll try to attack you. If you're unsuccessful, then you won't get anything to eat, you'll be hungry. Why don't you just, you know, parinibbana now, and then that's it, no more suffering. Huh? And so the Buddha says, at that time, shortly after his enlightenment, the Buddha then said, I will not pass away until the fourfold community, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, is fully established, well-developed, well-learned, capable of teaching and passing on the Dhamma. Okay? So he said this straight after he was enlightened. And then Mara comes to him again close to his death when he's 80 years old, and he said, well, Lord, you said you wouldn't pass away until all of these things have happened. Look, now it's happened. Yeah? Now you've got all those things. You've got the fourfold assembly. They're all developed and well-developed and everything. Get out of here. Yeah? And so he said, all right, I will. So it's very interesting, isn't it? The death of the Buddha died because he agreed with Mara, right? It's kind of curious. Right? It's also curious, the question has been raised sometimes, did the Buddha commit suicide? It's kind of curious, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, he didn't physically commit suicide, he didn't stick a knife into him or anything like that, but it's very clear that he said he relinquished the life faculty. It was a deliberate, clear, conscious decision that he said he would not live on any further. Yeah? And maybe it's done purely psychologically, but is that any less committing suicide? Yeah? Kind of interesting question, isn't it? So the Buddha says, okay, I'm going to pass away. There's quite a few other interesting events that happened around that time. But one thing I'd just to note in terms of, I mentioned before, this is like a little novel, like a literary text. So remember, it's been put together, it's been composed. And I just now talked about that event where the Buddha referred to Mara, the two episodes with Mara, one just after his enlightenment and then now just before his death, yeah? And so there's actually two texts involved. You know, one text, the enlightenment text, and just after the enlightenment, and then the other one of the Parinibbana. And those two texts are talking to each other. Yeah, one of them saying, I'm not going to do this until this happens, and the other one saying, well, then you said this. Yeah, and so clearly these two texts were composed together. Right? They're coordinated together. Whoever put them together, and remember, it's all done in an oral literature. It's quite an extraordinary thing, yeah? I mean, if you've ever tried to, you know, write a song, you know, I mean, I used to be a songwriter, right? So try to keep, like, five verses in your head, right? they're not that easy. But here you're keeping not only one very long, complex literary construct, but then coordinating and editing that with another one, yeah? To dealing with quite a separate period. And that's not the only point of similarity. There's actually a whole series of maybe half a dozen or a dozen obvious points where these texts have been coordinated and integrated, you know, to form a kind of a spanning biography of the beginning and the ending of the Buddha's teaching career. So another very important event that happens at this point is that the Buddha gives a teaching on what he calls the four great standards, four mahapadesas. So remember that this teaching is in this climate of uncertainty. The Buddha is approaching the last days of his life. Not only is the uncertainty within the Sangha, but also with the environment around, the death of the beloved old kings and the coming to power of the more bloodthirsty younger kings, and the political instability, which in fact was very real. We know that we don't know the intervening history of the next 100 years or so. But we do know that is when the kind of curtain draws again, yeah, there's about 100 years, we don't know what happened after the Buddha passed away very much. But when the curtain draws back on history, everything was completely changed. And that whole realm in which the Buddha travelled, which was the Sakyan Republic, where the Buddha was born, the Vajjian Republic, the Kosala Empire, and some other smaller empires, and all of those had completely disappeared. They'd been wiped off the map forever, within 100 years of the Buddha's passing away. And they'd all been swallowed up within the new great Magadhan Empire. Okay? So the feeling of instability was not, it was not irrational or unreasonable. They were actually entering into a period of great instability. And so there's all these measures contained within the text where the Buddha's talking about how do we find stability, or what, how do we actually hold things together. And one of those teachings is this thought, Maha Padesa. The word Padesa means a reference. Okay? Okay, so the four ways, four situations or ways of referencing, or situations in which one needs a reference. And basically what the Mahapadesas say in simply is that what the Buddha taught in the suttas and the Vinaya should be regarded as the standard for what the Dhamma is. Okay, so he says that if one's approached by a teacher, say a very elder teacher, who says this is what the Dhamma is, then you take that, you compare it to the suttas and the Vinaya, and then you see whether it lines up. And not only if it's just one teacher, even if it's a whole school of teachers, even if it's the entire Sangha says that this is what the Buddha taught, you have to take that and compare that with the suttas and the Vinaya in order to determine what the Buddha actually taught and what he didn't say. Okay? So what we're seeing here is setting up of a specific textual authority, yeah, for as a guide for the Dhamma. So there's an implicit tension here. Because all the way through this text, as well as teaching this textual teaching, the Buddha is also pointing to the importance of experience. Okay, so the experience of the truth is always the final criteria in Buddhism. Yeah? So there's this tension which you find between is our authority what's written in the text, or what's said in the text, or is our authority our own experience? And in practice, we have to balance these two kinds of things. But the Buddha is here at least depicted, whether it's historically true or not, but certainly he's depicted as saying that the suttas and the Vinaya should be regarded as the final authority in what is the Buddha's teaching. And that's a passage which still has great resonance today, because of course it still comes up constantly in discussions about Buddhism, of what really did the Buddha teach, what's the Dhamma, what's the right way to practice, this teacher says this, that teacher says that, and so on. And so coming back to the suttas and the Vinaya is always certainly something that I've found to be very useful in that regard. We don't know, of course, whether when that passage uses the word suttas and Vinaya, we don't know whether it means literally the same thing that we have today in the actual scriptures that we have today. Yeah? I mean, presumably it's related to them, but it's also presumably not identical. But in any case, that's another complex area. When the Buddha actually summed up those teachings, okay? So throughout this text, again, he sums up what is that message that I've actually taught, abhinya, satchikatwa, having realized it with my own direct knowledge, okay? Abhinya Satchikatwa, that teaching. And when he says that, he teaches always, again and again and again, through this, a set of teachings on the practice and meditation. That set of teachings we call the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the 37 wings to awakening. Okay, and they consist of the four foundations of mindfulness, four Satipatthanas, the four right efforts, the four Iddhipadas. I mentioned before these are the four Iddhipadas, what the Buddha said he developed that could let him live on for an eon. The five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers, seven factors of enlightenment, and the Eightfold Noble Path. Okay, so if you add all those up, you get 37. And so that's what we call the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. And this is what the Buddha says again and again and again. This is my teaching. This is what I, having realized with my own direct knowledge, have taught you for the last 45 years, that you should remember, that you should understand, and that you should practice, that you should pass down, and that you should practice to realize for yourselves. So this is one of the great themes of this Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Now the Buddha continues on with his journey, and eventually he comes to a place in what's now known as Kusinara, that's in the Vajjayan Republic. So this is, of course, has a kind of political implication, right? So remember, come back to the beginning of this whole text, He's in Rajagaha. So there's a whole ambiguity to this whole thing. He's in Rajagaha. King Ajatasattu is talking to him, and he says he's going to destroy the Vajjayans. The Buddha speaks in praise of what the Vajjayans are doing. Yeah? And he then walks to where the Vajjayan Republic was to pass away. Right? Now, he's not saying anything nasty to King Ajatasattu, but there's clearly a message there, isn't there? Right? He's clearly saying, you know, I'd rather be remembered for dying in the Vajjayan Republic, even though actually more of his life and more monasteries and things were in Rajagaha than there were in Vajjayan Republic. So that's kind of interesting. But it's also worth remembering that historically, of course, it was the Vajjayans who were destroyed. Yeah? It was the Vajjayans who were destroyed, and and Rajagaha which ruled. So politically, the Buddha's making a statement which had a very sort of pointed meaning at that time, but which may have been somewhat inconvenient in later years, right? Because in later years it was actually Rajagaha which ruled everybody, yeah? And so in later years there was a great effort by the Buddhists to associate themselves with Rajagaha, with the rulers of there. Yeah? I just mention this because we often don't reflect on the political context of these particular things, you know. But it's as if, you know, 3 weeks ago I'd written an article saying how good Kevin Rudd was and how great his policies were, and how fantastic it was that his redhead wasn't running things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the situation changes, and my article would no longer appear to be so expedient, right? So that perhaps suggests that this text was put together at an earlier time before the ascension of Rajagaha. Anyway, the Buddha gets to this little town of Kusinara, and Ananda says to him, "Why on earth have you chosen to die in this little backwoods village of wattle and daub huts in the middle of nowhere? Why don't you go to one of the great cities and pass away there?" And the Buddha gives then a story of his past lives and said in the past that this was a great capital. And so then it comes time for him to pass away, and there's this very beautiful moment, very sad moment, when Ananda thinks the Buddha's passing away, and he goes off, he leaves the Buddha, and then stands leaning against the doorpost and weeping. Yeah? So poor old Ananda, yeah? Going off, having a good cry, you know, he's a bloke, right? And blokes don't do that, especially if you're a monk. You know, you're supposed to be pretty tough if you're a monk. You're not supposed to cry and have feelings and things like that. And so, Ananda is like, you know, and what does the Buddha do? Does the Buddha say, "Ananda, you wimp, grow up"? And no, he calls Ananda back to him, and he teaches to everybody. Because you imagine the other monks, what the other monks must have been doing. They're like, "Oh God, Ananda, here he goes again, off with the waterworks. How embarrassing! I hope those Jain ascetics don't see that. They'll really have a go at us for this." And the Buddha calls him back and says, "Ananda," and he says, "Here," he teaches everybody, "these are the four wonderful and marvelous qualities of Venerable Ananda." He said, whenever Ananda is teaching, and then goes on to list these great qualities, and he basically says that whenever he's teaching the Dhamma, that people love it so much, they love to come and see him, and they find such joy to listen to him teaching the Dhamma, and when he finishes, they beg him to keep on teaching for longer, because they just want to, can't get enough of what he has to give them. And so it's a very beautiful passage where you see the Buddha, you know, giving this loving care right up to the last moment. And so then it comes a time when he's lying down and about to pass away, and there's too many details to go into here, but just right up to that last moment, as he's lying on his deathbed, he's still giving teaching, and still he's only concerned to help others. And he says, you know, "Is there anybody here who has any doubts about the teaching? I'm going now. Yeah? You won't have any time to question me in the future. Does anyone have any doubts?" And everybody's silent. Yeah? And Ananda says, "Isn't it marvelous that nobody here has any doubts and questions?" The Buddha says, "Well, you say that out of faith, Ananda, but I say it because of my own knowledge, that there's not a single person here who has any doubts about the teaching." He says, "But nevertheless, maybe somebody's just too nervous to speak up." Yeah. because here I am lying on my deathbed. He says, let a friend tell a friend. Yeah? If you have any doubts, tell it to your friend. Let them ask for you. This is the extent that the Buddha went to. It's a very small little detail, but I think such a lovely thought. Yeah? Let a friend tell a friend. And still nobody had any doubts. So then there were a few things that the Buddha did just before he died. One of them was, he said, Ananda, he said, give the supreme punishment to Channa. Right? Now, of course, poor Channa must have been really devastated by this. Channa, of course, was the Buddha's charioteer. And when the Buddha went forth, he was the charioteer. And apparently had become very proud and very stiff-necked and wouldn't listen to anybody and wouldn't respond to any teaching or admonition. And nothing that they could do could get him to behave. So imagine that, almost the Buddha's last words. And he says, give Channa the supreme punishment. Yeah? Everyone standing around, God, Channa must have been mortified. And he says, what is the supreme punishment? Okay? The supreme punishment, what does that mean? Beheading? Torture? Supreme punishment is, whatever he does, just don't talk to him. Yeah? Silent treatment, yeah? So that's the worst punishment in Buddhism, yeah? Silent treatment. It worked, by the way, later on. He was mortified. He did ask for forgiveness and he did become an arahant in the end, so that all worked. And another thing the Buddha said at that time... Sorry?
After the Buddha died.
After the Buddha died, yeah. Another thing the Buddha said was, he said, if once I've gone, if the Sangha wants to, it can abolish the lesser and minor rules. Okay? So during the Buddha's lifetime, he'd set up this monastic code we call the Vinaya. It's got hundreds of rules in it, which sort of govern all behavior in all kinds of circumstances. And so the Buddha said, well, don't worry about the lesser and minor rules. And this has become a constant source of controversy in later days, because Ananda, whose mind was clouded by Mara yet again, forgot to ask the Buddha, which ones do you mean when you say the lesser and minor rules? Yeah? So afterwards, the Sangha's having this big debate, which one's the lesser and which one's the minor, and they're all kind of arguing with each other, and no one... For 2,500 years, nobody's ever agreed on what rules are lesser and which ones are minor and which ones can be abolished. Yeah? So they just decided to keep them all. Right, so this is another thing Ananda has got this kind of guilty conscience for. So it's very interesting, I think, to consider this text as something that was probably composed by Ananda and yet includes quite a few of these episodes where, you know, as well as his love and devotion and so on, but there's also seems to be this feeling of guilt. I mean, he didn't get the Buddha his glass of water. For a start, yeah, and then, incidentally, he's responsible for the fact that the Buddha died, yeah. And not only is he responsible for the fact that the Buddha died, he's responsible for the fact that all the Sangha have to keep all of these trivial little rules forever because he didn't ask a simple question. Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of interesting. So then the Buddha, his last words, yeah. I am Tathagata Sapachimavacha. The Vayadhamma Sankhara Apamadena Sampadeta. All literal translation is all conditions are subject to decay. Strive on with diligence. So that's a literal translation. A colloquial translation would be things fall apart. Yeah? Just keep going or just do it. Yeah? Things fall apart. That's his very last words. And that's, to me, such a beautiful encapsulation of the Buddha's entire teaching, Vayadhamma Sankhara. Yeah, that's how it is. That's how the world is. Everything's fall apart. Appamadena Sampadeta. Keep on practicing. Keep on striving. That's it. So then, according to the text, he then entered into the four jhanas and the four formless attainments, and then back up, and then back again, and then to the fourth jhana. And then he passed into Parinibbana from the fourth jhana. And then, of course, there was another earthquake. Another one of the eight occasions for earthquakes. And the various verses were spoken in his honour at that time. And the most famous of those verses is the verse Anicca Sankhara Upadavaya Dhammino Upajitva Nirujhanti Te Sanghupasamo Sukho which is recited at funerals, at Buddhist funerals, until today. And that translated means Anicca Vata Sankhara, means alas, all conditions are impermanent. Upadavai Dhammino, their nature is to rise and fall. Upadjitwa Niruddhanti, having come to being, they pass away. Te, and then the killer, the great part of this verse, Te Sangvu Pasamo Sukho, their stilling and their passing away is bliss. Yeah? Their passing away is happiness. Yeah? The stilling of conditions is happiness. Te sang wu pasamo sukho. So I was kind of curious. I'm not sure how much in the Buddhist culture people actually realize this. Is that what we're actually chanting at the funeral? You know, all the monks come together and we're actually saying we're so happy now that this person has died. Te sang wu pasamo sukho. Good-o, now they're gone. Of course, the context is talking about, you know, parinibbana, yeah, the kind of release from all suffering, final release and liberation is what means te sangu pasamo sukho. And it was never meant to apply in the case of all funerals, but there you go, that's what happened. So, I won't go too much into the story of what happened afterwards, but what you can see, just to encapsulate that tension that's been sort of felt all through this text, at the end, when the Buddha's passing away, the Buddha's community is very clearly divided into two. The arahants, the enlightened ones, reflect on the Buddha's passing away and say, this is impermanent. What has come to be will pass away. How could it be otherwise? Yeah. And then the unenlightened ones cry out, alas, the I has vanished from the world. Yeah? Wisdom has vanished, the light has vanished from the world. They beat their breasts, they wail, they roll around on the ground with tears running from their faces. Yeah? And so there's these two parts of the community, and you can see this depicted in a lot of paintings and murals. If you see traditional paintings of the Buddha's passing away, you can see these different communities, the arahants reflecting mindfully, and then the unenlightened ones weeping and so emotional. And so that's almost like a split in consciousness in the Buddhist community. It's a very, very different response. And that tension played out throughout the evolution of how the Sangha survived and how it grew, which is, of course, another story. And it's still something which is felt today in the way that we relate to Buddhism. Yeah. In a sense, you know, we come to Buddhism to let go of our attachments. And this is something I first learnt when I stayed, my first monastery I stayed in, you know, and there was a group of us who'd arrived at this monastery around the same time, and we'd done the retreats together, and then when one of them was leaving and everybody else was crying, yeah? Oh, we'll never see you again. And, you know, you could begin to realise that there's this kind of, you know, well, we've just been practicing letting go together for the last 3 months, and well, yeah, there's still things there. So anyway, this is my talk for you this evening on the Buddha's Mahaparinibbana, and I hope that's been entertaining and amusing and possibly educational. And I can invite us to any comments or questions or lamentations. Alter ego.
What it could be, how the mind draws the opposite view.
Oh, yeah, like the shadow or the dark side of the mind, yeah? Definitely, yeah. I mean, traditionally, Mara is understood as referring to different things in different cases. In certain cases, Mara is clearly meant as a purely a psychological force. In other cases, the text presents Mara as a deva, as a heavenly being of some kind. And so both of those meanings are acknowledged within the tradition. of course, with Buddhist cosmology, the basic fact of Buddhist cosmology is that our rebirth depends on our state of mind. So it's the subjective maras, yeah, which cause the actual birth of the objective maras, if you like. So there's not really any difference between those two in Buddhism. But definitely, and the mara is like the dark side, and he's presented in the story. The role he plays in the narrative is very, very much as the Buddha's shadow or the Buddha's dark side. Not Buddha's personal dark side. This was, I think, a mistake that was made by Stephen Batchelor. He sort of read the whole thing very on a literal psychological level, as if the Buddha actually, because there's a story that presents a shadow side, therefore the Buddha himself must have had a psychological shadow. But that's got nothing to do with it. It's actually, you need that in order to tell a story. A story needs tension in order to drive the narrative. And so Mara is introduced as a figure who creates that tension. You know, die. He comes to the Buddha and says, now you've enlightened, now you die. So he's voicing a very real possibility. I mean, it's a very real question to ask, actually. You know, you're fully enlightened. You know, why, you're not afraid of death. Why don't you just die? Yeah. I mean, it's actually quite not an unreasonable question.
It sort of reminds me a bit of the Socrates death, you know, in sort of saying, you know, his father's saying, don't drink, you know, we'll help you escape.
That's right, yeah. And Socrates is just perfectly rational and perfectly reasonable and just discusses with them the thing.
Did he actually choose to drink the poison?
Yeah.
Well, he virtually, somebody, it's very fascinating. I mean, at his trial, he virtually just goaded them into giving him the death sentence to start with, you know. And because at his trial, his crime was corrupting the youth, right? And they found him guilty. And one of the good things about the Greek legal system is that they actually ask the prisoners to suggest their own sentence. Okay, which is actually a very, very good idea. The court doesn't have to accept it, right? But you can suggest your own sentence, and if you make a reasonable suggestion, then there's a good likelihood that the court will accept it. And it seems likely that if Socrates had asked for banishment as a punishment, then they probably would have accepted that. But instead, he said for his sentence, he said, well, I'd like the state of Athens to set me up in the town hall, with quarters in the town hall, so that I can continue teaching the youth as I have been before. And then, as before, it's like his friends come to him and says, "Go on, Don, so you could have asked for a more reasonable one." But anyway, they convicted him of thing, and then later on they tried to bust him out of the jail. And then he wouldn't go, so he just drank the hemlock. Well, he was executed, but he decided to comply with the state's decision. Mm-hmm. He didn't, by the way.
Well, but he was poisoned.
Buddha?
As I understand, he was
the last meal.
No, the Buddha didn't have a thought process about his passing. I just you know, he just okay. But anyway, go on.
As I understand, a blacksmith gave the Buddha.
This is another one of the controversies, yeah. Whether he died from that illness or not, yeah.
And
yeah.
So the time frame of the Buddha and Plato are very similar.
Yeah.
And that was right as the world was becoming developed, or the modern society.
Hmm.
So things were building and they were becoming developed, centralized systems. So the blacksmith, or that welding of metal development is a major function.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the blacksmith offering that food to him, which poisoned him, they're kind of conflicting, or they're different. It's always a philosopher that has problems with that development and that, that political group that's making the
risk. Yeah.
So I took it very metaphorical, at least initially, which it may not be appropriate, but it was that wanderer lifestyle that doesn't try to achieve or doesn't try to collect, and is poisoned by that system that develops and creates infrastructure.
No, it's very interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that seems that's actually quite an interesting idea. Just for those who are not sure of the background, one of the episodes which I missed out in that story was that the Buddha's last meal, another famous controversy. The Buddha's visits this smith, as you said, Chunda. His name's Chunda, and he was given the last meal, and the last meal was what they call Sukara Madhava. Sukara meaning pig, Su being related to the English sow. Yeah, so Sukara is a pig. Sukara Madhava means something like a tender bit. So it's always been controversial in Buddhism what Sukara Madhava actually means. Does it mean tender bits of pig? Or does it mean, sometimes interpreted as being mushrooms or some sort of tender thing that pigs like, or perhaps just being, often foods just have purely idiomatic names and you can't really work out what it is. In any case, that word's only found in the Pali, and in all of the other versions, it's not found. The only other version says tree ears was his last meal. It's one of the Chinese texts. The Buddha's last meal was tree ears. Yeah, so you all know what tree ears are, don't you? Have you ever seen trees with ears growing out on them? Yeah? No, they have mushrooms, these fungus that grow out on trees. Yeah? Yeah? So tree ears, yeah? So this is some kind of fungus. Anyway. So he ate that and he got sick. He got very sick and almost died. The text is unclear whether he actually died from that or not. So it's a bit of another quite controversial passage. Can be interpreted different ways. But I think that's actually a very interesting thing. And remembering also that I was just saying that actually it seemed very much that the society tipped into war and violence shortly after the Buddha passed away. And the specific connotation of the smith, of course, is that the main use of iron is for making weapons in those days. Mm. Yeah, making swords. That's what the Iron Age was basically about. Yeah. So definitely could be something to that. And it's also significant because most of the iron was in Rajagaha. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why Rajagaha became dominant, because they had the iron reserves, so gave them the military advantage.
I took it as a Kapapa. Modernism maybe wasn't so great for the spiritual life. I guess I took it out of the Buddha context but applied it to a larger kind of metaphor.
Interesting. Yeah.
Why do you think the Buddha didn't
want to
live forever?
Crikey. There's a Greek myth about that. I can't remember his name, but the king who asked for a wish, and he got his wish was to be able to live forever. Yeah, got eternal life, but he forgot to ask for eternal youth. So he lived forever, but he just kept on getting older and older. 100 years, 200, 300, 400. Doesn't get any better. Yeah. So I think it's a very sensible decision.
On the side note from the two arguments, they commented on that claim the bowl.
Mm.
Okay. In India, I did something similar with two ascetics that were meditating, and they were. I took sit down and took pictures with them. One was like a pirate, and the other one was another kind of had a bunch of Hindu gods woven into his hair.
Mm-hmm.
Very very commercial looking aesthetic. And at the end of it, I took pictures of them, and they about to leave, and they kind of tapped me on the shoulder and was like, money, money, money.
Mm.
And because I wanted to see which of the two were the most giving or the most generous and sincere, I had a 10 rupee and a 5 rupee, and I gave it to both of them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to watch the two of them. I wanted to see if I actually got the 10, and of course it was the bigger one.
Uh-huh.
Pretty funny.
Well, that's a lesson in human nature there.
Old and had enough.
I reckon so, yeah. 80 years.
Yeah, that wondering would be exhausting.
Sure, yeah. Well, I don't think it was quite as bad in those days. You know, but it is pretty hot, yeah.
Does Buddhism have any sort of attitudes about suicide?
Well, it's a very interesting question then, isn't it? I mean, it's actually, that case is a dubious one, but there are certainly a couple of suttas where arahants definitely commit suicide with a knife. And so there's, I think, at least two cases where that happened. That was both cases where they were arahants, and they were in sort of terminal illness. So they were basically, you know, just suffering terribly, and they knew they were going to die very soon, so they just used the knife to cut short their life. So that's definitely cases of voluntary euthanasia by arahants.
Setting himself on fire in protest.
Well, that's another one, yeah. That's probably, I mean, that's a slightly kind of debased form, but it's based on another form of arahant suicide, which was to what the really cool arahant would do, right? Like the really dead cool way to, if you're an arahant, is you would get to go around to all the sangha and call all the sangha together and say, everyone come together for a meeting from the monastery, and you'd sit down in the middle of them. And then you'd fly up into the air and burst into a ball of flame. Yeah? So there's nothing left behind. Everything's just consumed and burnt up. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool. Yeah. So a few of them did that. So this idea of monks setting themselves alight, I think, is actually a kind of a debased form of that. You know, in fact, what it was this idea of, I mean, whether that actually happens or not. I mean, there was a case in Bodh Gaya about 3 or 4 years ago. It was this nun who just burst into flames and disappeared. She just burst into flames. She just Bhutanese nun.
The Tibetan practice.
There was nothing there. There was no matches or petrol or anything like that. Yeah, she was like this old nun. No one thought anything of her or anything like that. She was just doing sitting meditation. Got old. She's gone. True. Police investigated and so on. They couldn't find any motive or anything.
Also, Tibetan tantric practices, records of people self-mummifying themselves in old age. They stop eating and they start meditating and they have a choke strap. And they just
So are there any values associated to any of this that we know from the Buddha or the Lama?
What do you mean, values associated?
Thou shalt not end their own lives.
Well, obviously, generally speaking, yes, not considered to be a good thing to commit suicide. But
isn't that considered killing a being?
Yeah. But obviously, you know, there are exceptions. Yeah. So how far you want it doesn't give any exceptions apart from arahants, right? But there's obviously a bit of wiggle room there. Yeah, so it's, you know, and it's definitely a very important question. Yeah, it's a question of voluntary euthanasia. Definitely.
Which leads to the subsequent question. When you said arahant use a knife to pretty much end the suffering, if there are arahants, aren't they supposed to be able to kind of tolerate that suffering because they've let go?
Yeah, women. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you still feel the pain. I don't think the question would be can they endure it. The question is, well, what's the point? Yeah. So if you can say, well, I can survive because I can be of benefit. Yeah. It's the same question about why didn't the Buddha pass away after his enlightenment? Well, the reason he didn't was because he could be of great benefit to people. Yeah. Whereas, and actually, you know, this is why I think he died, like why he actually, even if he could live on, the reason why he died is because what would really happen if he didn't, right? If he really didn't happen, if the Buddha was still alive today, he would be a god, right? Everybody in the world would just think of him as a god, and there would be this devotional cult of everybody going and you know, worshipping him. But in dying, he embodied the Dhamma. This is the reality, is impermanence, yeah? And even I'm not escaping from it, so that in itself is a teaching.
How literal do you take that conversation?
Very?
He could live forever.
Not very.
What was that? The conversation with Ananda and him saying he could live for the entire eon if he chose to.
Yeah, and what was the question?
How literal do you take it out?
Maybe he meant like a very long human lifespan, 100 and something years or something.
Or mm-hmm. just the teachings of his, that Ladon could be a part of his life.
Mm.